So if Ray changed the subject matter a little bit, I'm going to change it a lot. I'm not going to talk about transport properties today, although this subject was certainly motivated by it at one point. It was motivated by the desire to understand on an energetic level what is and what is not going fast in some of the cases that we've been talking about. This is a problem, so I'll be solving for you effectively today, a problem that's been around for about 50 years. At least we'd kind of like to think that Landau and Lifshitz made some statements to this effect. It wasn't sort of thought about very carefully until the mid-90s by Oxton and Sherman, and this is the problem. In real time, how can you make a determination or a calculation of the separation of energy in a dielectric into two pieces, namely that which is still available to do something useful and that which has been dissipated, degraded to unuseful forms? And if I have time, which I probably won't, I'll get to the some interesting mathematics, that of the Riemann-Hilbert problem. So I have collaborators. Grohl-Venetian was a visitor to Brigham Young last year from Armenia. Curtis Broadbent, who you've all met, and Melissa Clayton were students of mine. Or, well, Curtis still is. Melissa's now at Penn State. And Justin Petrus has arrived today. He's an experimentalist at Brigham Young. So I have two goals in this talk, and that is to develop for black boxes, so things for which we only have a notion of input and output, ideas of free energy and heat, and then more specifically to actually talk about dielectrics. And so the point being here, so things are sort of parallel. So phenomenological in the second paragraph is supposed to be parallel to black box in the first paragraph. Phenomenological dielectrics and black boxes more generally. So this is the history of the problem, the specific problem for dielectrics, and that is if you write down the conservation law that we call Poynting's theorem, there's this energy density in there, and it has sort of two pieces, the first two pieces, which are sort of energy which is stored in the field in a sort of a purely electromagnetic type of way. And then there's this third term which records the interaction of the field with the matter. In the controversy, the question has surrounded this last term, this interaction of the field with the matter, and which I call the interaction energy. So back in 1994, in their book on this subject, Oxton and Sherman talked about how this third term, the interaction energy, should by all rights be decomposed into two pieces, a piece which they labeled reactive and a piece which they said would give us the absorbed heat in sort of real time. Well, this is the statement. So we have this equation at the top which is analogous to what they wrote down, but not precisely the same thing. They say it's evident that one may associate the first two terms on the right-hand side of the equation that gives this formula with the energy density in the field alone, and the last term with the electric energy that is interacting with the dispersive medium. And then they say a certain portion of this interaction energy, this third term, is reactively stored in the medium and the remainder is absorbed, giving the evolved heat. And then they say, unfortunately, this separation is found to be intractable analytically. Well, our contribution to this subject was not just analysis. We actually had to decide what sort of questions needed to be asked. That is to say, we had to do some physics. So this is kind of the conceptual breakthrough that we made. So instead of saying reactive and absorbed, let's say reversible and irreversible. And then to sort of put things on a more colloquial level and to make another connection, let's say that this first piece is available and this other piece is unavailable, and then more specifically, let's say that the first piece is available to do work and the second piece is not. So, back.
The fact that it's not absorbed is by definition reactive. So does that include scattering?
We don't have these sort of, the game that we're playing is with the phenomenological dielectric. We have sort of local constitutive relations. They're phenomenological. They're handed to us. There's no sort of notion of a kind of a microscopic theory that's giving rise to these things. I think it may become clear a little bit later as far as what we mean by this. They're meant to be identical. So, Who else asked me this? Mo asked me this, that's right. So I guess the notation's confusing. Imagine instead of those integrals there, imagine having the symbol U sub int. So there's yet another subscript is all. That we have this object on the left, which is U sub int, and we want to separate it into two pieces, U sub int sub available to do work, and U sub int sub available not available to do work. If each one were half, if the division were just equal.
Correct. How could it not be equal if the expressions are identical?
How can the expressions?
The available is a subscript on that term. It's the same term, but the available says, well, here's part of it, and then there's another part of it. We don't know how to separate these two.
Maybe become clear a little later. Yeah, that's what I was trying to say, but because Mo had the same question. That's right. So this is the sense in which we'd like to attribute Landau and Lifshitz to this problem. They say that back in 1958, so in the absence of dispersion, where you have this instantaneous relationship between the displacement and the electric field and the magnetic induction and the magnetic field, that the object that you find in Poynting's theorem has exact thermodynamic significance. They say it's the difference between the internal energy per unit volume with and without the field, several things remaining constant. In the presence of dispersion, no such simple interpretation is possible. Moreover, in the general case of arbitrary dispersion, the electromagnetic energy cannot be defined as a thermodynamic quantity. This is because if you have dispersion, then you have dissipation. So a dispersive medium is an absorbing medium. Well, our issue with this is that we think it's completely false, but the problem is that they never went to the trouble of actually defining what they meant by internal energy, at least not even in a way that was consistent with their other notions in their text. So, and there's this whole dictionary of the use of terms, which I'm going to skip right now. So I'm going to tell you, obviously, in great detail how we do this, but for right now, I'll give you a naive picture. The naive picture is that we have some sort of black box, so an object for which we have no notion of the internal workings, only a notion of relationship between input and output, and the naive picture now is that we sort of pour energy into a system, and then there's this question of sort of how much energy is still available, still around, and how much is lost. And the key, of course, is to say precisely what you mean by how much energy is still around. Something that I spent about a year doing was the wrong thing, namely trying to look at microscopic interpretations of these things, which maybe has some connection to Peter's question. It turns out that the microscopic approach, just sort of this desire to know what's inside the black box, is actually the wrong thing to do macroscopically. So the naive approach would, microscopic approach would be to say, okay, our system does have some internal workings, whether or not we're privy to them, and the dispersive elements of the system maybe should be those which contain energy available to do work, free energy, and the dissipative elements of the system would contain solely the losses. And so let me give you an example of why this is the wrong thing to do. And there's this perfect analogy between the type of dielectrics that we're considering and just LRC circuits, just passive dielectrics. So suppose I have this particular LRC circuit, and I've got these various inductors here and capacitors, and I'll actually choose numbers at one point. This integral right here is the power produced by the voltage source. Okay, so it's the power that is lost, shall we say, by the voltage source to the system. And with this idea that we have dispersive elements and dissipative elements, one might be able to write out this quadratic form in detail and show that there are various terms which are associated with what we might call dispersed energy and various terms with which are associated with what we might call dissipated energy. And I'll actually write those quadratic forms for you. You actually see here the energy in inductor 1, which looks a lot like a kinetic energy term. Same for inductor 2. Here's the energy that's associated with the capacitor 1, which looks a lot like a potential energy term, similarly for 2. And then, of course, there's these other terms which are sort of naively associated with the losses. Well, the horizontal axis is time, the vertical axis is energy. At time t equals 0, we imagine applying some delta function voltage across the leads to this circuit. And since this electric field that we apply has compact support, since its support is just at t equals zero, we have this immediate jump in the internal energy of the system, so that energy which was required to create the system state. So it goes from some value that we call zero up to some value around 5, that's the blue curve. And then, the naive approach is to take the last two terms in the expansion of the quadratic form that we saw before and sort of plot them as a function of time, which is what we're doing here, and that gives us this sort of orange curve. And it turns out that that curve is always different from some more holistic viewpoint, a curve that we can draw from more holistic considerations, which is this green curve. And in fact, you can always show that it's always less than that or never exceeds it. And so this green curve I call system loss. Now, I've yet to describe to you precisely how we determine the system loss, and that's what I'm going to do in a little bit. But let me just give some more names to some of these things. So this bottom curve, I would call it the sum of the ohmic losses. The green curve I might call the black box loss. The yellow curve I might call elemental losses. The green curve I might, if I have a notion of heat, I might call the green curve macroscopic heat and the yellow one microscopic heat. And the important thing that I'm about to show you in a few minutes is that the green curve is sort of model independent and the orange curve is model dependent. And there's a few other things I could say about this, like from a macroscopic point of view, the green curve is observable and the yellow curve is unobservable. The difference between either of these curves and the total energy that's been put into the system, the internal energy, is the various notions of free energy, so the various notions of energy available to do work. So, we have macroscopic free energy and, shall we say, microscopic free energy. And again, I haven't defined the green curve for you, so is that the issue? Okay, so let me... That's true, but there's a sort of a cumulative effect that we're missing here that I'm about to describe. Okay. Let's see, the other direction. Okay, so suppose instead of the circuit that you just saw, you remember it was two, we had LRC in series and another LRC in series and then those two elements together in parallel. What do we have here? We have LRC in series together in series with a sort of a composite element, which itself is three objects in parallel. Well, it turns out, and we have, I guess, here one more resistor than we had before. It turns out you can choose the capacitors and inductors and resistors in just the right way so that this circuit has precisely the same admittance impedance as the previous one. That is to say, from the outside of the box, you cannot tell the difference. Okay? And the naive notion of losses is, of course, now given via three terms since we have three resistors. And I'm going to plot for you the time evolution of the sum of those terms, and what you get is this red curve. So again, what are we seeing? We're seeing two systems which from the outside of the box are indistinguishable, and yet from a microscopic point of view, that's the way I want to say it, that they have very, very different notions of energy allocation, energy losses. Okay. So the question now, of course, is how do we get the green curve, which is, by the way, the same for this circuit as it was for the previous one. We have only ohmic losses. But again, we're sort of not. We haven't got to the punchline of why there's this other notion of losses. But at one point, in some sense, it does all come down to the resistors. But it's how it comes down to the resistors. So if we had no resistors, there would be no loss in either of these. Well, sort of two viewpoints here. So it turns out, as I will summarize at the end, that the interaction between the resistive elements and the dispersive, the lossy elements and the dispersive elements is non-trivial, and always is. Okay, so let's skip some of these things. I saved this talk for various venues. Okay, so let's talk about the general goal. The general goal was to provide a notion of free energy and heat for black boxes, be they dielectrics or circuits or anything else. And so the idea here is that we want to describe in an unambiguous fashion a dynamical notion of free energy and heat for a system, irrespective of the microscopic mechanisms which give rise to these properties. And there's various ingredients, which are on the bottom in yellow. The first ingredient is this. This dynamical notion of the total internal energy in the medium has to be viewed as the effect of a cause. And in particular, there has to be distinct notions between past and future. So in other words, we have to have causality. So I'm going to show you a little cartoon here. So we have this black box, and we don't know what's in it, but we do nevertheless want to allow two bins for placing various types of energy, conceptually. And what we do is we couple this black box to the outside, to the environment, and we do so via, say, a pump, the handle of which, the motion of this handle of which we record. And this vertical line is time, and we're going to record the motion of this handle. We have a notion of past, and we have a notion of future. And the previous principle that I pointed out is that before we move the handle, there can be no energy in this system. Okay, just that simple principle. The second ingredient is that this total energy has to be thought of as the amount of energy required to elicit the causes time development in the system, so the cost of creating the current system state. It really is, so if we actually are looking at a circuit, for example, and we produce this system state by plugging the leads into the wall, it really is proportional to the bill that you'll get at the end of the month. Okay, so it's very physical in that sense. Okay, so we imagine moving this handle around, and we're, you know, the idea is we want to have notions of energy allocation within the black box, and yet we're not allowed to look in the black box. But what we are allowed to know is how much energy we've put in. And it turns out that that's enough to know, eventually, after some manipulation, enough to know how much energy went into each of these bins. The way we do that, well, let's see, okay. So another ingredient is that this total energy, okay, well, this is a uniqueness thing. I'm going to skip uniqueness. This is something to do with eliminating active circuits and so forth. Okay, so this is what we do. We define the free energy practically, that is to say, in a sense, macroscopically. The current free energy of the system is the maximum amount of work the system can perform against the cause in the future. So the maximum component of the current total energy, the energy you've put into the system, that can that the cause can subsequently recover from the system. So again, without then we define the heat as kind of what's left over. So the current heat of the system is the fraction of the current total energy that the cause cannot, under any circumstances, recover from the medium. So this is the idea. We imagine, after having excited this system and put energy into various bins but not knowing where they went, what we do is we imagine moving this handle around in all possible ways. And among all these ways, we should find a best way, or at least a sequence of things which leads to a best way. And we are then able to pump back out of the system the maximum amount of energy that we can. And this amount that we are able to pump out eventually, this may take time, is then the free energy that was in the system previously. Of course, the free energy now will be zero after we've done that. So just by knowing the amount of energy that's been put into the system and can be taken out from the outside world, we do have an allocation of energy inside the system without looking inside of it. Okay. So there's some more issues that have to do with uniqueness and so forth. Okay, so specifically for dielectric, the idea of Oxen and Sherman was to call these things reactive and absorbed. Our idea was to talk about reversible and irreversible. Maybe this notation would have been less confusing to you, right, to just put that subscript there, right? What we define the irreversible component of the interaction energy, at time t, importantly, to be the infimum of the interaction energy over all those new times which are in t's future. So all of the new times which are greater than t. There I've said it, t prime greater than t. And so then the reversible component of the energy is the current interaction energy, that is to say the current the cost of creating the current state minus that which we can never get back. So I have a picture which I think will motivate it, and I'll talk about rebates and so forth. It turns out, for example, my wife, her parents, across the street from her parents are some people that have photovoltaic cells on their roof, I guess, and they, whenever they produce more power than they consume, they can actually run their meter backwards, and they can get, well, either a rebate or perhaps they never get the larger bill. So I've got some cartoons to that effect in a moment. Well, I put those definitions in quotes. You may have seen some quotes there. I should describe this a bit more carefully. So this quadratic form, the interaction energy term, depends. We have the electric field in there. We have the polarization. But we can think of the polarization, of course, as depending upon the electric field itself via some susceptibility. And so what I have here, a definition in quotes, is replaced by one without quotes. So I'm being very precise now. And that is, we think of taking the evolution of the electric field and truncating at time t. This h stands for a Heaviside function. The minus means that it exists in the past of time t. And then we imagine appending to this electric field, which we have become aware of from minus infinity up until now, we append to that some future field. And this what we do is we take this interaction energy and we evaluate it at time equals infinity. And then we take the infimum over all possible future evolutions. And this leads to various interesting mathematics, which I think I will probably skip. But here's the cartoon. So this is the typical evolution of an interaction energy with given some field. So I think, yeah, so here's, let's say, the field that created the evolution of that interaction energy. Now, some qualitative features here which are unique, which are generic, is that the interaction energy as time goes to minus infinity is zero. It's a normalization. And then as time goes to plus infinity, it may achieve some maximum value, and then somewhere in between it may achieve some maximum value, and then as time goes to infinity, it might reduce to some lower value, but it'll always be positive in the case of a passive medium. This curve you can think of as the, if you were charged, if you were to close your account with the power company and you were getting this power from the power company, if you were to close your account at this time, this would be proportional to the price you would pay. And if you were to close your account at this time, this would be the price you pay. But then there's some sloshing around of energy in your house, and this energy somehow or another ends up back in their grid, and so you get a partial rebate. Okay. So the idea here is to get the most rebate we can, the largest rebate we can. Oh. So this value at t equals infinity is the value that Landau and Lifshitz tells us that we should call heat. And then the question of Oxton and Sherman was, you know, what should we call heat at any other time? Can we have a dynamical notion of heat, or is it only after this process is done that we can ascribe this notion? How do we ascribe notions of heat and free energy at any given time? Well, the thing I've just told you is that it has something to do with the infimum over all possible future Landau-Lifshitz heats. Let me show you exactly how we do that. So we pick some time t at which we want to define this allocation, and that time defines a past and a future. We hold the past fixed, and we leave the future up for grabs. And what that means is we hold the past electric field fixed, and we leave the evolution of the future electric field up for grabs. So one can imagine appending this past fixed field with various future fields. And here I've actually demonstrated some discontinuities. It turns out the discontinuities are sort of important to this game. And associated with each of those evolutions of future fields are evolutions of the interaction energy. Among all these, there should be a minimum, or actually more generally an infimum, so a sequence of such things which leads to an infimum. And this minimum value of the interaction energy, which is the Landau-Lifshitz heat, we then transport back to time t and call that the loss at time t.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. One possible future field is zero field.
Yeah.
So wouldn't the minimum be zero?
No, if you look at it, a moment ago I mentioned closing your account. Closing your account, the better way to say it is sending the field to zero. It turns out that let's say you sent the field to zero. Any ideas what the interaction energy would do? So it turns out it's not that the interaction energy will go to zero. The interaction energy will actually get stuck at that value. So that's closing your account. Okay. So you can just, if you write down that integral and stare at it enough, you'll determine that. So here's a calculation that Kurt did. So on the left, you see the envelope of some field which is impinging then on a single Lorentz oscillator type of dielectric. Okay, sort of the simplest thing to look at first. And on the right, you see the evolution in blue of the associated interaction energy, so the real-time cost if you were to close your account. And the green curve is the free energy in the system, as we want to call it, so this energy which is available to do work. And the red curve is the heat. So the red curve is effectively, at any given time, the red curve gives the minimum bill that you will actually receive. Okay. So how do we change this? Justin could probably explain that better. Those oscillations are.
The envelope on the left contains standard oscillations, and here you have an extremely thin envelope, and on the right you have.
So on the left it's an envelope, on the right it's not. So on the right we're actually resolving.
So those oscillations indicate the frequency under the envelope?
Yeah.
In phase with what?
Well, if you zoomed in on the green and blue curve, where they're going out, they're probably out there.
They almost certainly have to be in phase, because if you look at the red curve, see the red curve and the green curve have to add up, and the red curve has almost no oscillation on it. So they almost certainly have to be. Is that right? Because you put it on the other side. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so on the left we have this evolution of some field that we were intending to throw at the medium, and the question is, what's the best one at any given time to, how should we change this field in order to get the maximum rebate? So at some time near zero, we decide we want to get the maximum rebate, is what we see on the right. The little lump that you see here, this lump here is the same as that lump, we're just looking at it on a different scale. And it turns out the best thing to do is not to continue the way you wanted to continue, but to rather append a delta function, which is indicated by this spike, and then in some sense to apply a DC field with a certain fixed amplitude, which depends on precisely how the system dynamics, how the state has been prepared at that time. Now, what do I mean by in some sense? It turns out that, so you can see the red curve, it says ideal. Ideally, you should apply this DC field, and then you see some other curves here, what is that, magenta and blue, are associated with some curves that actually fall down rather quickly and don't look very constant at all. It turns out if you actually apply this constant field, the red one, and here we see a blow up of it versus some non-ideal future fields, if you actually apply this this red curve here, it will take forever for you to get your rebate. So if you want to actually get some money out, before you retire or something, then you need to actually append one of these other fields here to get it in a finite time. Of course, you'll pay a price for that, and it's that price that I'm going to show you here. So so if you try to get your money out, if you try to close your account fairly quickly, try to back out fairly quickly, you'll be stuck with this cost. If you take a bit more time to back out, you will get this cost, and the infimum of all such future evolutions is this red line here, and that's what we call the heat. Okay. Well, I should go back and say, does anybody know what we're looking at? A single Lorentz oscillator here, so we're thinking. Think of a mass on a spring, okay? And there'll be quite a different story if we look at anything else. It turns out, but a mass on a spring. Why in the world would you have to? Why would you want to hit it with a delta function, and then follow it with some sort of something close to DC? Well, the idea is that for a mass on a spring, you have notions of kinetic energy and potential energy. So the purpose of the delta function is to take this mass which is moving and slap it so that it stops, and you thereby extract all of the kinetic energy. And then the purpose of this, well, call it quasi DC field, is to then slowly relax the potential energy. And you have to do it slowly, because otherwise you generate more cost in the process. Now, it turns out that this simple picture does not apply for even as simple as adding two Lorentz oscillators. Well, I just want to convince you that these definitions that I've given you are good ones. When you have a good definition, a lot of theorems follow. And if they have physical significance, then you're very happy. So suppose we have a time t which is greater than some other time s. You can show by this definition that the irreversible component of the interaction energy for that time t has to be greater than, or at least is never exceeded by, the irreversible component at this earlier time. And the proof is just tautological from the definition. It has to do with the fact that you're looking at infima over the future. And if this irreversible component were to ever decrease, then it would mean that you actually did not find the infima after all. And the significance, I think, of this theorem is that this thing that we've called irreversible fraction of the interaction energy is well named, that it actually does record the irreversibility of the medium field interaction. And here's the picture, that if we were actually to plot this heat, that quite generically, we would find that it can only increase, or in any case, can never decrease. One other very interesting thing is, suppose you take composite media, and I mean composite in kind of the simplest way. I don't imagine any sort of chemical processes or anything. So we have our interaction energy, which is the irreversible component, which is not only a function of the field that we've applied, and therefore the state that we've put the system in, but it depends on, well, it depends on the constitutive relation, the relationship between the electric field and the polarization. Well, you can imagine making some kind of composite medium, as indicated by the plus sign here, and it turns out that this irreversible component is always greater than or is never exceeded by the sum of the irreversible components of the two. And I have a proof for this, which I think we'll skip, but I think we won't skip sort of the significance of this, as well as its corollary, which has to do with the reversible component having an inequality the other direction. The significance is that energy available to do work within individual constituents of composite media can never combine constructively. Alternatively, creating composites generates irreversibility, heat, entropy. This last principle. What defines composite here? So I had hoped to head off that question by some of those things I said, but yeah. What defines composite is this symbol here. So you imagine there's this parameter, chi, and you imagine taking the sum of a medium whose chi is effectively the sum of two other mediums' chi's, right? So it's composite in this sort of cheap sense, if you will, I suppose.
Black boxes in series, or
it would be in parallel, actually. Because chi's are admittances. From the electrical engineering point of view, chi's are analogous to admittances. The reciprocal would be analogous to impedances. So you're adding the admittances, so that's in parallel. This principle that I just mentioned to you jives with some other things that you know. Which, you know, if we didn't have that previous principle, if we had that the heat of the sum is the sum of the heats, we would then conclude that you can never generate heat. And the reason we would do that is that we can take any chi and we can write it as a sum of, at least in a limit, we can write it as a sum of chi's which are dissipationless. And so what one would conclude, if you had an equality here rather than an inequality, is that this irreversible component of the interaction energy, this thing that we want to call heat in the end, would be the sum of a bunch of zeros, okay? And so we would not get any heat in the end if it weren't for this principle that when you develop a composite, you actually generate some irreversibility. So let's see. So that's effectively this picture again. So if I look at the elemental losses, as I called them before, the ohmic heats, that will always be less than the system loss, which, and you saw that they were in parallel, right? But where is it? These were in parallel. And yet, this loss here and that loss there is sort of related to each of those resistors, you see. But that sum, that sum there is the sum of the irreversible interaction energies for each piece separately.
Can you pinpoint where the system loss comes from?
It comes from the fact that things take time.
You're saying that the composite
Yeah.
Okay, now where is that?
Okay, this is where it comes from. So this, you know, let's imagine the difference between either of these two curves and the blue curve. Those are the various notions of energy available to do something useful. The difference between the bottom curve and the top curve, this orange curve, this sort of elemental, this curve that's associated with the microscopic way of looking at things in the top curve, would be the energy that you could actually get back, it would be proportional to the rebate that you could get back from the power company, if you could, at any given time, instantaneously cut apart the circuit and cut apart the leads to the capacitor and plug those into the wall, cut apart the leads to the inductor, plug that into the wall, etc. But if you're going to leave the system as constructed, so you're not going to demolish your house or whatever, then the only rebate you can get is associated with the green curve. So the green curve is intrinsically associated with the fact that the medium is constructed the way it is.
So just as you're pulling that out, some currents have to flow through those resistors that you're trying to get
in. Yeah, you know, this curve here, you notice the upper limits of integration are time t. It sort of ignores the fact that there's going to be a future here in which you hope to get your rebate. Okay.
Another way to say it is the ideal field to extract energy from circuit one is not ideal for circuit two, so you're stuck with a compromise. You're always going to end up with some current of some sort going through one of the other resistor, and that's what you have to consider is already.
Yeah. And I'll try to close here really quickly, but let me just show you what happens for two Lorentz oscillators. There's something very bizarre that happens here. So what are we looking at again? We're looking at, so the blue curve is the energy that we've thrown at the system, and the black curve is a measure of how much we could never get a rebate for, how much is lost. So let's just look at that black curve. And on the same curve, let's put the evolution of the impetus for all of this, which was that at time t equals zero, we applied a delta function voltage across the system. So I've got energy on the vertical axis, but actually it's also simultaneously field. So the black curve is energy. The magenta curve gives you the amplitude of some delta function which hit the system at t equals zero. So let's just look at that. This is this field that we applied that is creating this heat. And now what are those black curves? The black curves are a piece of the future field that we should apply to recover as much energy as possible at any given time. So you can, this makes a lot of sense. At t equals zero, what should you do? At t equals zero, you should make it so that whatever thing you wanted to do plus that which you were going to do negate each other and you've done nothing. Okay, so we had a delta function of unit amplitude. Here we have a delta function of unit amplitude, but different sign. Okay. And then at some later time, say this time, we should apply a delta function with a slightly different amplitude, but the same direction. And at one point, this changes. These are only a fraction of the future fields that we should apply. These are only the delta function, the distributional pieces. These are the pieces that you might want to think of as associated with kinetic energy, although there's some ambiguity here as soon as we have two Lorentz oscillators. So in addition to this delta function component of the future field, there's these other regular components. So at time t equals zero, we have only a delta function in the opposite direction. At this later time here, we should, after we hit with the delta function, we should then apply this field, which oscillates a bit, and then gets stuck at some value. And then, let's see, you know, say this time here we hit with a little delta function upwards, and then we then follow with some finite amplitude field which oscillates a bit and then gets stuck at some higher value. Now, you'll notice that each of these future fields gets stuck at, they look like they go to constants, and in fact they do. But what I'm plotting for you is kind of these adiabatic limits. What you should, if you actually apply the fields that I show you here, you will not get all of your rebate. You will miss the, as it turns out, you could call it the potential energy part of. And so what you have to imagine is these going out there for a very long ways and then slowly coming down to zero so that you can extract the potential energy as well. So unlike the single Lorentz oscillator, where what we saw was that after you applied a best future field, the cost, the instantaneous cost, if you will, immediately goes down. You immediately get some rebate. For a two Lorentz oscillator medium, sometimes what you have to do, and is indicated in some of these curves that go above the number 5 here, that sometimes you have to actually extract more energy from the power company in order to organize your system so that you can finally have your troops are organized a bit better, and you can do a better job there. So this is intrinsically, if you see a curve like this, you know that you don't have a single Lorentz oscillator there. You know that something funny is happening. So, and I think I'll probably skip the rest of these. So, so the only question is, you know, how do these curves, which are the evolutions of the costs, compare with this curve here, which I said is heat, or the cost that you will definitely have to pay. And I'm sorry for the change of scale here. But it turns out, so these asymptotic values of the energy here are associated with the amount for which you cannot receive a rebate at each of these times. So you make this connection. It's drawing something for some reason. So I'm going to skip these. And let me just get to... So there's some mathematics, the mathematics of the Riemann-Hilbert problem that shows you that you can actually take, say, experimental data and plug it in, that you don't have to have a notion of a Lorentz oscillator or two Lorentz oscillators or anything. And here's the formula. So it turns out that the irreversible component of the interaction energy is something that you can compute with just experimental data. Here's chi. We know what that is. The only new thing that we have to describe are these two objects here, a phi sub plus of omega and an E sub tau. So it turns out that the E sub t is the Fourier transform of your electric field composed with a Heaviside function, so it's a causal sort of thing. It doesn't know about the future. You take this Fourier transform, that's an object that appears here and is important. Phi plus is, and there's also a lambda, a parameter lambda that I should describe first. Lambda records sort of the asymptotics of the system, how dissipative it is at infinity. And phi plus is a certain limit of, sort of this object that we use to define the dissipation at infinity. It involves taking the logarithm of that object and then taking a Cauchy integral and then taking an exponential. So it's sort of a conjugation of a Cauchy integral on this measure of dissipation. So you have all these formulas, and you can readily confirm that the irreversible component of the energy is never negative. Same for the reversible component. Moreover, you can show the irreversibility, which I proved to you in kind of a trivial tautological fashion just from the definition, but you can now make sure that the formulae actually respect that. So if you actually take the derivative of the formula that I gave you, you will find that the derivative is never negative. For the irreversible component of the interaction energy. And then you can actually show that the reversible component of the interaction energy never increases after the field quits subsidizing its existence, so after you pull the plug out and no longer connected to the grid. And so what you do there is you unfortunately have this instantaneous spectrum sitting here. And so after some time t0, when the field goes to zero, this instantaneous spectrum is sort of stuck at this t0 value, and then when you take the derivative, everything falls out, and you find that the irreversible energy can only reversible energy can only decrease. So here's my conclusions. The notion that the dispersive elements of the system contain solely the free energy and the dissipative elements contain solely the heat or losses ignores the dynamic interplay of these things. And I guess another way I would say it is it ignores the fact that recovering energy takes time to do. And the interplay between these elements is not in general is not such as to allow these individual allocations to be measured externally. In particular, if you're thinking about a dielectric and sort of these microscopic things truly are microscopic, then what you would need at that level is actually a Maxwell daemon to recover the microscopic notions of free energy and heat. Okay, so. So the punchline, I guess, is almost that consequently allocations based on individual dispersive and dissipative elements is artificial. Those allocations are only relevant if you have a Maxwell daemon. Two internally distinct systems can have precisely the same external energetics and but their internal notions of dissipation are completely different, but nevertheless not measurable externally. And so the final picture I'll leave, hopefully indelibly print something on your mind, is that you have these two representations of a system which give you two different notions of heat on the microscopic level, but they have the same notion of heat on the macroscopic level. Okay.
The first one is, if I'm thinking of a reversible energy, and it should be a state dependent on path independent. The way you define it.
It's definitely path dependent, isn't it? And it's because, you know, we don't take just any old path. We do have to take this path, which, as Ulf says, we have to steer the system in just the right way to get out the maximum amount of energy. And so that's a specific path. That's correct.
So that looks like path dependent.
That's true. And so perhaps calling it... So what we're doing is we're generalizing some of these notions that you have in sort of systems without dissipation. In a system with dissipation, all of a sudden things become path dependent.
Two questions. One is that I'm worried that you're using thermodynamics requires steady state. And so these steady state notions are somehow buried in your approach, aren't they? And the second question is, how do you define entropy?
That's true. I shouldn't have tossed out that term. This is something that I've been looking for a long time, sort of buried in the mathematics and our physics of this problem. And in fact, there's some very suggestive things in the mathematics, like the presence of logarithms and so forth. But no, I cannot at the moment ascribe a notion of entropy. But you had another question as well.
Steady state.
So I don't know what to tell you other than all of this is dynamic, but it's meaningful, you know.
The dynamic definition is, at any given moment, what's the best you can do at infinity when things come to rest? So it's a real-time definition in terms of a steady state, what you're going to get.
The lack of distinguishability between two systems, which you posited. Two systems that from the outside would be indistinguishable, but if you could look inside, you could see the work on distinction. Yeah. The test that you make that leaves you to throw up your hands and say, oh, I can't tell the difference between those two, obviously doesn't include the test of energy recovery at infinity.
Right.
That distinguishes. So what set of tests do you limit yourself to when you say that these two systems are indistinguishable?
The only thing I limit myself to is actually not knowing what the systems are. So not being able to go in and cut apart the individual elements and say, plug them into the wall. But that if I'm going to extract energy from the system, I have to do it in the way in which it was constructed.
Transfer function determines everything.
As it does here.
If I take two black boxes and I have that as two terminals, and we measure we take a network and we measure the real and imaginary part of the response of function at low frequency, how can you convince me that the two can indeed be different?
I may not have understood the question, but it would seem to me that it's irrelevant to me whether or not they're different on the inside. If I only ask questions about what's going on in the outside. They're precisely the same. Yeah, I may not have made that clear. They're precisely the same. Yeah, you can't measure that from in order to.
I measure from outside the real and imaginary part of the response function. Being identical, then the response of the two systems should be identical at all times for the same input.
As they are here.
Really recover is the same.
So chi is a quantity that gives you information about the system as a whole. It doesn't say what's going on the inside. You see. It just gives you the cumulative effect of whatever you know, however the system.
The division of reversible and irreversible energy of the two systems is not identical.
They are identical.
So this, in other words, it's all determined by the time.
That's true. Very good.
Actually, the question of coming into maybe slight generalization of what we did for low light and light storing experiments, very essential point is that we make the high also time dependent. So now I wonder, I mean, so most of your definitions in the notion will carry over to a case that you allow your chi to be time dependent in the future.
But I'm anticipating some much harder mathematics there. It turns out that this mathematics was not all that easy. It was mathematics of the Riemann-Hilbert problem.
Increase your degree of freedom, let's say you restrict yourself of not having amplified media for your view.
That was actually one of the slides I skipped, and I said, let's not talk about amplifying media.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
if you allow for all possible chi's, but isn't it the case that in whatever system you're thinking about that you've sort of fixed the game, you've sort of fixed chi?
No.
Even if it depends on time, you've nevertheless fixed that dependence, no?
Oh.
So you're just trying to say that one way of one view of sort of cutting things apart is thinking about a time dependent chi.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, sure. So if the I've always really resisted working with active media, and Justin has opposed my resistance. But it turns out if the medium is completely active, meaning active at all frequencies, so it's generating energy at all frequencies, then you can play the game. But as soon as it crosses, then you don't have a bottom to anything. You have a saddle. And so you can go up as far as you like, and you can go down as far as you like, and nothing makes sense anymore. So in the type of media that you're talking about, actually you could play the game, I think, where you just take the Lorentz oscillator and you sort of change the sign, because I think that's active at all frequencies. I think that's active at all frequencies.
Yeah,
so you could play the game there.
Only and see if that's bounded by C or something.
I just want to make a couple of points. One is the original proof that you couldn't separate that is due to Barash and Ginsburg, a very well-known paper, at least it's well-known to George and I back in 1976. and that's what we quote in our book. So I'm honored that you try to say that George and I came up with that, but we did not. We just put what Barash and Ginsburg did, which is a very nice proof that they claim that you cannot make the separation. The second comment is that for the Lorentz, so they basically claim that you need to know microscopically what's going on. And if you know the details microscopically, and you do the calculations right, you have to come up with the correct macroscopic answer. There's no other way around that. And then we've done that for a microscopic material. We've taken a look at a pulse going into a Lorentz medium, and we track the evolved heat, and we compare that in the calculations with the quantum vector calculation of what you know with, what you know goes in and what you know goes out, and how much heat is evolved, and everything is there.
Yeah, you realize for a single Lorentz oscillator, the macroscopic and the microscopic heats, as I've talked about them, are precisely the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in the case when you have two of these together, or more, or something more general than anything we've discussed, that these distinctions come up. You realize, say, for example, that orange curve there, we had an LRC and an LRC. That's like having two Lorentz oscillators. But if I just had LRC, that's it, the two curves would be
You're
on top of it.
You're talking about taking two individual Lorentz oscillators, and they're actually coupling back and forth between each other, and then the macroscopic,
only through the field.
Only through the field. But so a single Lorentz oscillator is a very simple thing, and microscopic and macroscopics agree.
But the alternative microscopic model does have some hodgepodge where it's sort of more complicated molecule that's responding and throwing like separate oxygen and nitrogen.
Yeah, I don't think we've done that case, but I mean, we've got calculations for something for a realistic material like water, for example, which has separate resonances, but that's different from what you're thinking about. You're thinking about
That's the same story. My point is this: if you have two Lorentz oscillators and you think about the kinetic energies that each of the masses have, you know, so I'm thinking of masses on spring, and the potential energies that each of these masses have as a function of time, the sum of these kinetic energies, together with so plus the sum of these potential energies, do not equal the amount of work that the system can do. And this has to do with the fact that they sort of fight each other, I guess. So the sum of the microscopic, kinetic, and potential energies.
One of the oscillators radiates energy, the other one can absorb some of that and dissipate.
Via this field that you apply to try to get it to do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, the one set of oscillators is starting to radiate.
And again, we should be very happy with this, because if this were not the case and you use Cramer's cloud ink, you could prove that every media has no dissipation whatsoever, because you can always reduce it to a sum of these dissipationless oscillators. Peter. So is implicit in your statement the idea that Maxwell's equations are behind this, and we should be talking about transport? And
yes.
Okay, we have right now we're just developing the forms which are applicable point-wise, and then one can sort of insert these into Maxwell's equations and wonder what happens. So if the time evolution of the field at this point is such and such, then the time evolution of the field at some other place has to be related to that via Maxwell's equations, and we haven't done anything like that yet. Which is why I said at the beginning that I've really changed gears here. We're not talking about transport as yet. Part of the program, as I mentioned to you earlier, was to eventually talk about what it is that is going fast and not going fast from an energetic point of view in these media, but we haven't done that yet.
This is a local in space, but not local in time.
Mm-hmm. But the... You realize the theory can still be inserted into Maxwell's equations. We just can't. We just haven't addressed what transport properties and so forth.
Well, we should take